Enterprise Management 360, your main source for tech news, analysis, podcasts, and videos for the enterprise.
Welcome to the EM360 podcast, where we have a weekly conversation with people who are impacting the enterprise tech landscape. My name is Jonathan Kerr, and I'm an advisor at Lionfish Tech Advisors. I've been in the industry now for some 30 years or so, and it's a pleasure to be here again talking with you. Today, I'm joined by Arik Attar, Senior Threat Intelligence Researcher at Radware, and we're here to talk about advanced threat intelligence and why you need it. Arik, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Jonathan. Thank you very much.
Okay, so it's actually a real pleasure to be talking with somebody who is, on the front lines, gathering intelligence on what the significant and organized attackers are doing and the threats that they pose. So let me open with question with, what is your perspective on the current risk landscape right now?
Well, I think that we are coming to the stage into a new era in which, while corporates try to think like hackers, hackers begin to think like corporates. They practically building their own businesses, which is just like service, like SaaS startups. They are offering a product as a service. So we are seeing a full separation between those hackers that plan the attack and the hackers that actually commit the attack. Their buyers is actually the ones that doing that. Right now, we are seeing around 8 different DDoS as a service tools, for example, that they charge 400 rubles for executing a DDoS attack on every possible site. They are developing different models per industry. Like gambling sites have one type of model. According to the vulnerabilities they found, they find on these verticals, on those industries, they are practically offering tools that are capable of doing complex and advanced attacks, something that we never seen before. In the past, it used to be really simple UDP flaws and all this kind of all the vectors that we've seen, and now they are able to change those vectors during the attack and offering basically a DDoS tool for renting. And that changes the game totally, because if by now the DDoS field was totally controlled by nation-state hackers that had a lot of resources on the one hand, but they had a narrow interest in damaging like specific vectors to specific industries, now every gamer that loses a game and wants to take down the server, the gaming server, just as a revenge or to feel some power, he can do it without even knowing how to write a single line of script. So basically, it's kind of like what IKEA did to the furniture industry. Everyone can do it by himself, and they can rent these services online. And it's not just DDoS, it's mainly account takeover tools that used to be very segregated in between forums of the darknet. Now they are offered on Telegram. So to sum it up, I believe this is the first time, historically speaking, that our kids have on their cell phones access to these powerful hacking tools that grown-ups are spending their living for defending against, and they are able to do this kind of sophisticated attacks without any technical knowledge, which was the main barrier for a lot of hackers to get into this game.
That's really interesting. I think that if we think about the traditional security methods, I guess we all understand that. We all understand the perimeters. We all understand the, trying to move the inspection up the stack. So moving towards the application layer away from the away or above the network layer and that and so on. And I guess the question is that, how do you compare the traditional security methods and, the outcomes we achieved there against more advanced security methods that are now reading and analyzing behavior?
This is a really interesting question. I would say that the comparison is the equivalent of the police officers trying to use mugshots, like pictures of the criminals, in order to get them. This was the traditional way to defend. It's a signature-based defensive. This is what traditional DDoS defense or bot mitigation defense mechanisms are relying on. They are taking a snapshot of how the attack looks like. But hackers picked up on this, and they created very powerful tools that constantly change the way they look like, which is the equivalent of a criminal that knows that his mugshot is published around, and he knows that he might be given to the police. So he's going to a plastic surgeon and he's doing changes in his face, and therefore no security camera can see him anymore. So the more advanced security methods is much more like interrogation room. In interrogation room, you put the prospect, you put the suspect there, and you ask him question. And it's not what he answers, it's how he answers, it's how he behaves that lets you know who he really is. So basically, in this matter, I would say that we moved from taking the mugshots of the attack, or then doing interrogation, doing active analysis, doing some challenges in the session itself, so we can see how the tool, the traffic is behaves around it, and therefore we can conclude if it's a real human or not, which is the big question of application security.
Well, that's fascinating. And I think, as you say, having these tools that allow the defenders to look at behavior, understand behavior, I guess, also ultimately leads us potentially to analyzing intent. And so we can determine the intent, whether behavior is harmful, or whether behavior is beneficial. And I guess the question from that would be, well, how are modern attackers changing up their methods in relation to how we interact with our technology? And you know, the example that comes to mind off the top of my head is certainly targeting children's games. You mentioned that briefly earlier.
Basically, hackers and attackers are constantly on the hunt for digital assets. Since in the last decade, we all moved our services into cloud, into apps. Now we have our government apps on our phone, and we have the airline account on our phone, and there's a lot of miles in it. So they are constantly looking for the type of asset and how they can use it in really creative ways. In the context of gaming, the gaming industry moved from selling a game and that's it to selling an experience, to selling something, an access to is practically a cloud-based game. And in order to incentivize gamers to be as much as possible in the game itself and use their product as much as possible, they created this whole gaming economy. And if you have kids, you probably know that they are spending a lot of time, and for that time, they're getting gaming currency, like digital coins, like V-Buckets that Fortnite, for example, uses. For every hour, you get this amount of gaming currency, V-Buckets, and you can use it to buy in the store of the game itself all kinds of digital assets like swords, ranks, stuff that looks for us, for non-gamers, kind of ridiculous to spend money on it. But for a 16-year-old kid to have the specific rank is the equivalent of a businessman that comes with a Rolex on his hand. It's not about knowing the time, it's about the social status. And if we can recall what we did when we were 16 to gain social status, we can see that we can understand that basically teens will do anything for that. And it's including running a lot of bots on gaming sites that collect those V-Buckets, and then you can centralize them in one specific gamer. I actually had an investigation 2 years ago on a gamer from East Europe. He did, in 10 days, he simulated 30,000 gamers with bots that ran on Fortnite, and he collected a lot of V-Buckets With those, he was able to buy really expensive swords and sell them online for real money. And when I'm talking about real money, it's $6,000 to $8,000, $6,000 to $8,000 for a single sword. And when I get a chance to talk to him, of course, not with my real identity, but with my one of my hackers' identity, I told him, who will pay this amount of money for a sword? And he told me, for you, it's a sword. For them, it's a totally new social status tomorrow in the classroom. He's coming there, and he's in a level that all of his friends know that they will need to spend 6 months playing in order to get into this. So they're all jealous in him. So he takes his dad's credit card and he buys it because he can't afford it. But this underground marketplace is actually where all the this bot environment has developed over the years. And now we are seeing the same tools that was used back then to simulate real human interaction by machines using right now on e-commerce sites or travel sites or government sites sometimes. And of course, they are overkill because they have trained and optimized those tools and those bots for years. And all of a sudden, they are getting into new industry that never knew this problem before. And we're having gamers in their mindset, they are also very persistent. They have what is called a grit, the ability to climb on a mountain, even though stones are being thrown at you, to the ability to tolerate failure. Because the price, when we think about it, for gamers of failure in gaming is practically doesn't exist. If you fail in a game, you get back to the last level that you were. It's not like real life. So when they start to do application attacks, they see every step as a new level in the game. This is their mindset. So they are willing to take much larger risks than other threat actors would take. And they don't get frustrated when they fail. And there's a lot of failing when you do this type of attacks because it's practically walking in a cave that you can't see anything. And every time you need to throw up a stone in order to hear where the wall is, where's the limits. So basically, it's a new attitude and it's a new tools. And the combination of those two creates really comprehensive attack that simulates humans in a way that the target will never see it coming. They will see it as real users coming from real neighborhoods. One of the most common attack vectors for all application threats, the only one that is the single one that is common for all of them, is mobile proxies. So they are using mobile IPs right now because they can do much more actions per minute from a mobile. If you think about it, your mobile screen is a 6-inch to a 7-inch top, and you're doing much more actions on mobile comparing to PC. And therefore, the threshold of rate limiting, which is the traditional security method to protect against bots, is much more flexible. It's usually three times more than PC. So vendors, traditional vendors, and the target itself, allowing more actions to come for mobile. So they are using that as well to simulate everything from the IP to the fingerprint of the attack itself. The way it uses the screen resolution, the way they are moving and touching the screen, everything is simulated to the last detail. So it will be almost impossible for the target or traditional vendor to identify if it's a real human or not.
Right. And I think that you bring up something very important there, because again, we know that in the press, people are talking about the resurgence of modern slavery, coerced working, sweatshop activities where people are, grinding and building up characters and, as you say, winning weapons and so on. But I think the other side of this is what you've just mentioned is the automated software agent, which is our friend the bot. I know Radware, and Radware has great expertise in this. And one of the things I've also seen in the press is that there's this concern around romance scammers and, you know, this idea of pig butchering. Lovely, lovely title, but essentially it means that the scammers fatten up one's ego before slaughtering one's bank account. And I'm curious, what's Radware seen in this area?
So practically our threat research team has noticed that bots practically allows those scammers to scale. It's the most important thing that startup will talk about is scalability. And this is exactly what hackers are on the hunt for, because bots simulate real humans and it can do it in a way like hiring 30,000 people that will start a conversation with adults on dating apps and try to social engineer them takes a lot of money and a lot of time and human resources that hackers didn't have before. But now every kid can simulate this with the powerful tools that developed over the years and maybe even utilize existing tools. 6 months ago, I came across in a Russian marketplace one 18-year-old hacker that bragged about the fact that he was managing to run around 10,000 sessions on really popular dating app. He used practically a chatbot that was meant for enterprises for support. So it's the same chatbot that is used for minimizing the amount of people that is handling customer support. Just take the first steps to understand what the customer needs and have this kind of script. Now those tools have AI capabilities. And those are legit services that are being offered all the time online. But they are using it for different purposes. They are running it with scripts they took from dating apps. And all of a sudden, the chatbot knows how to react to a comment that in a way that will look really even cynical. They can use humor. It's not just a standard a conversation that starts with, hey, let's meet up or send pictures or something like that. It can be much more persuasive in the way. So people that didn't fall for that like 2 years ago, now they are in the risk, because understanding which session is about or not is almost impossible from the victim point of view. So it's really interesting trend. Although we can see people are like threat actors constantly upgrading their scripts, and constantly the conversation scripts are being updated through the AI tools that are being out there. So I can go to ChatGPT right now and tell him, let's simulate a conversation between a male and a female on dating app that results in the man providing his credit card. And ChatGPT will be really creative, but he will create this kind of a conversation. I can even introduce myself to ChatGPT, of course, not as an hacker, but as a UI designer that works for Tinder and wants to improve their user experience. Therefore, he needs to simulate this kind of conversations. So the way that the LLMs works as a statistical tool that was trained for so long on large database, all of a sudden provides them capabilities they never had before to extend the way that their bots are interacting with us. And it's not only the bot that buys the PS5 before me, it's now the bot that allows me to provide a credit card because he pretended to be a miss that is in trouble. And he pushed the button of me believing that I can save her. So it's much more a complex way to do social engineering, but it's not a complex operation anymore.
That's amazing. And I think it's fascinating how, as you say, criminals will do whatever they need to do to meet their ends. And that includes using, you know, new technology and using whatever comes to hand. But as you say, ChatGPT is fascinating. And obviously, it's very, very difficult, I imagine, to try and secure LLMs and other web-based applications against these growing, pervasive and pernicious threats. And I mean, really, I guess, you know, my final question in this interview is, how does Radware help?
Radware help by first, Radware has a visibility that very few, if all, like a vendor has. The fact that Radware is examining the web through all the endpoints, not just web interaction, but also API endpoints. This is really a common attack vector. When I started researching account takeover attacks, for specifically, which is the attacks that takes our accounts from us, the users, if you ever came across a person or even you yourself, you lost an account to a hacker, this is basically this type of attack. So when they started doing that, they were focusing on mimicking human behavior. Now, and back then, it was around 6% of the scripts that I've examined that are doing those attacks was relying on API endpoints. Now we are talking about 86%. So the vast majority of the attacks, application attacks, are happening through API. Some of them are still on the web interaction, trying to mimic the fingerprint and everything from the screen resolution to mouse movements of humans. But we are in this stage in which API and web interaction goes along together. The separation happens only on the vendor mind, but the hackers are using them both. So if I can make it even more simple, it's like web interaction, protecting against web bot mitigation, let's just say it like that, is like taking a bodyguard that keeps your house door safe. This is all he knows to do. He's specialized in doing this, like keeping on the doors so thief will not get in. And API security is like the windows, like just say. So if you have two vendors, one of them is guarding the windows, one of them is guarding the door, and a thief tried to go from the door to the window, the CISO will see it as two separate attacks, while Radware will able to correlate to do the cross-referencing in between all of its products and see the full time, the full scope of this attack and correlate it all together. So I believe this is the main relative advantage that I see here. And I worked for other bot mitigation companies in the past to say that the visibility that Radware has is something that is unprecedented in the AppSec field. Which is something that is truly, when you see the way that hackers are moving in between vectors, even in the same type of attack, they will switch between API and all of a sudden they are bot and all of a sudden they are doing a fake registration just to see who, which bridge credential is signed up on this target. So they will do, they will constantly change, just like HIV viruses constantly change the way it looks like, so our immune system will not be able to signature it. The main thing that I would consider, if I would be the point of contact from the other side, is a vendor that sees the web from all of it. Another example, really important one, is proxies IPs that I mentioned earlier. Like mobile and proxies IPs have an Achilles heel. They have a weak point that we need to consider. In every time, we have only few thousand IPs, proxy IPs, available in specific area. And since the attacks are geolocated, that means that a lot of threat actors are doing a lot of mess from really minimum amount of IPs. Let's just say like 3,000 IPs can serve sometimes 30,000 threat actors. So the target, the reason that it happens and it keeps happening is because each target sees only the IP that the targets her. And or every IP can target at the same time four different applications and sometimes even 40. The only one that will be able to see the if it's a proxy IP or not proxy IP is Radware that has customers from all industries. So when I look from Radware logs on IP, I can see that in 1 minute, one IP in specific neighborhood in Germany sent request to 22 sites at the same time, something that is possibly impossible to do when it's real human. So we have this behavioral analysis. We're not just relying on specific lists that are being provided. But we can also correlate in between the different products of Radware that sits on different types of attack and correlate it to the same and an attack vector that is used by all app threat actors, which is proxies. So proxy detection gets a new stage when you look in on the IP from different angles and you can see all the targets that it is doing as a vendor that works with many customers.
I think that's fascinating and I've learned so much. Arik, thank you so much for joining us today. I really, really appreciate you coming on. And also to everyone listening, thank you as well. We hope you took a lot away from today's podcast, and for further information on what we talked about, then please do head over to radware.com. We'll be back next week with another episode in our podcast series. Until then, make sure you subscribe to this podcast on all major platforms. Follow the conversation on our socials at EM360Tech on Twitter and it's LinkedIn. And for more great daily content, head on over to em360tech.com.